So yeah, well, it all started at the Sydney Olympics. I was there and the footing wasn't really great. And so you started paying attention. So from Sydney, I really started watching and looking at all different arena footings. And you know, when I think back, I thought, God, who do you call in North America if you want to build an arena? And I couldn't come up with anything or anyone. So I really started to think, wow, there's a real niche here.
There is a depth and a breadth to our lives that largely goes unexplored. As an equestrian life mindset coach and host of this podcast, I am here to lead you on that exploration. Deep conversations covering topics in and out of the show ring with industry leaders and unsung heroes alike, sharing their stories and what makes their journey unique, but relatable at the same time. We all have stories to share and lessons to trade, something we've learned from a horse or from each other. So relax and be ready to listen with more than just your ears. I'm Tracy Mitchell. Welcome to Hitting Your Stride. Let's welcome Karen Leeming to Hitting Your Stride today. Karen is a partner in Footing First, an innovative company that offers custom riding arena footing solutions located in Purdy's, New York. Karen brings her 30 plus years of equestrian experience to the company. An accomplished rider, Karen was also the manager of the Canadian Olympic Equestrian Team in 2000 and again in 2002 for the World Equestrian Games. At the Athens Games, she was part of the Kentucky Equine Research Team, responsible for meeting the horses' feeding and nutritional needs. Her experience in the industry, along with her intimate knowledge of the Footing First products, enables Karen to work closely with riders and stable managers to create the right footing surface for each unique situation. This was a fun, informative conversation. Karen's passion for not only her business, but her own story is palpable. The stories she shares, from her ponies to working as a groom to smuggling in beet pulp to the Olympics, are packed with laughs. To say that this woman is both bold and determined would be a vast understatement. I know you're going to enjoy Karen's storytelling in this episode, but I also know that you're going to get a lot of valuable insight into what it's like to really go after a life well lived. So let's put our first foot forward for the latest episode of Hitting Your Stride. Enjoy the conversation.
All right. So thank you, Karen, for joining me here on Hitting Your Stride.
Thank you for asking.
Yeah.
I've been looking forward to it.
Oh, this is awesome. And I met you when I was at the Royal doing the little mini recordings for an episode of the podcast with all the trade fair exhibitors. And it was moments into the conversation with you that I knew that this lady had to have a full episode.
Well, that's great. Thank you.
Yes, yes. Your bio was awesome. So let's get into this. All right. It would seem that one of the best ways to describe you would be calling you determined. You found a way to keep yourself around ponies as a kid, despite some challenging logistics. Then you found your way back to working with horses after trekking around the world. And then you found a way to smuggle in feed into the Sydney Olympics when you were the Canadian equestrian manager. Are you naturally a determined person, or does being around horses bring it out in you?
I just loved reading that question. you know, I think when you're young, you just would do anything to be at the barn with the horses. And that was all my life was about. Like most kids, I think, you know, you're just passionate about it. And I'd do anything. I mean, I cycled to and from the barn as a kid from the age of 11. I am determined. I was independent, but I was, because I wanted to be with the horses. So I did anything and figured things out to make that happen.
Made it happen. Yeah. All right. So please share with us a little bit about each of these aspects that I brought. So are brought up here. So your bio about you went to a show on one pony and came home on another. Please.
So as a kid, and I think every parent will relate to this, it's my father drummed into me. It's not buying the pony, it's keeping the pony. So I just, my very first pony, I think I told you, I sold for 150 bales of hay and 250 bales of hay and 500 bales of straw.
Yeah.
So that was great. And then the pony that I got next was lovely, but he was more of a hunter. And, you know, I'm trying to kick him around the jumper classes and, you know, make him get going. And he just didn't want to know. So there was this other pony that a kid was struggling with. And I thought, wow, he'd really fit me so much better. So I just literally went and swapped mine for his. And I came home and my father was like, who's this? And I was like, oh, this is Thomas. Thomas wants to jump. Not like that other thing. He just didn't want to know. So my dad, thank God, was just like, oh, okay. So I came home with a brand new pony, and because we used to hack everything so much more, you know, everything's closer in the UK. You know, I could hack to horse shows, probably hack to about 6 different horse shows.
Wow.
So there was lots going on all the time. So it was a lot of fun.
My gosh. Were you an only child?
No. I was the youngest then.
Okay.
I was the youngest.
So your parents were kind of worn down by the time you came along.
I think I'd worn them down to the point where when I was 9, I got my first riding lesson, but that was all I spoke about. And I think they were just like, thank God she shut up. And then really I was at the barn every weekend from then on.
Devotion, isn't it? It's just like, you know, there's a couple of questions here where, like, even me rereading them and preparing for this, it kind of shifts me back to that little girl magic.
Absolutely. And devotion is the perfect word.
Yeah.
You know, we do anything for our ponies or to be around horses. And really that's the correct word. It is. Like I remember as a kid, I think I was about 14 or 15, and I go back to England a lot, and I had let down this young, beautiful, wonderful, good-looking guy that asked me for a date, and I still know I've got a pony.
Oh my goodness, that's awesome. Yeah. All right, so tell me about the trekking around the world. I mean, that took you away from your ponies or your horses.
That did. We went around the world for 6 months. I was 20 years old at the time. My sister had planned it with a friend, and I sort of tagged along because of various reasons. And I mean, just such a great education, just traveling and meeting people. And again, figuring things out, you know, being dropped in Bangkok, never been abroad, and just being like, okay, where are we going to stay? You know, and it was great. And you learned to sort of calculate your risk. And we did quite a few fun things, risky things that turned out. And when you look back, you know, when I was 20, I mean, there was no cell phones. There was, again, our poor parents, they had me and my sister gone around the world. So, but it was great. And we were in Australia, and my sister and friend, both degrees, you know, very smart. Who gets the first job? Me. Riding school, within the first day of looking for a job, got a job, made money. And those two were like, took them about 2 weeks, 3 weeks to get a job where they could make money. Because of course, you know, you have to keep filling your bank account so as you can keep traveling. So our plan was to work. And again, the horses came through for me, you know. So
wow. It was great. That's awesome. Okay, now please fill in this smuggling feed into the Sydney Olympics.
Oh, this is a great story. So I ended up, again, various reasons, and I ended up the Canadian Olympic team manager. I'd worked with Torchy previously, so he knew, you know, what he was getting. And I'd lived in Sydney, Australia. So that was the biggest plus, was I knew exactly where everything was and I had friends. And so it worked out for me. So I was able to go a couple of weeks ahead of time. But my job, which was sort of only thrown out there about, I want to say, a couple months, maybe 3 months before the game started, was I had to get all the feed organized for the horses, which at the time I thought, well, easy, right? But as I looked into it more and more, you weren't allowed to take anything off the plane with the horses because Australia doesn't have so many diseases and things that the rest of the world has, obvious reasons with it being so far away from the rest of the world. So I managed to do everything except the beet pulp. And I had been in touch with Dr. Joe Pagan from KER, Kentucky Equine Research, who just does an amazing job. And he said, listen, he got everything. He helped me with absolutely everything except beet pulp. He goes, there's no way. And we had a mare and she needed a beet pulp. So I thought, well, you know, just take it as luggage. So I wrapped it all in brown paper and I contacted there was a place, it's called irradiation. So it goes through this screen of laser beams that will kill any bacteria that may be in the beet pulp. So luckily, again, I had friends in Australia. So I arranged everything prior to getting off the plane. So I had paperwork and I'm pushing my trolley and I've got these two big bags of beet pulp plus my luggage. So you couldn't see me. And I just happened to be obviously arrived exactly the same day as Dr. Pagan. And he just thought, oh, my God, this is her. And he's like, that must be Karen Leeming behind her. And I was like, oh, yeah, it is, you know. So the best thing was my girlfriend that picked me up from the airport came in an old Citroen. I don't know whether people will remember a Citroen, very old, almost like a buy a car in a pack. I mean, just a terrible car. But anyway, it has no room. So we had to put the beet pulp on the roof and tape it through the windows. Wow. So anyway, we got it to the horse show grounds. I did take quite a few bottles of, what's the Australian whiskey? Oh, not Jack Daniels, but it was a bourbon. Oh, I'll remember it. Anyway, for all my people that had been great. So, and into the show grounds it went. I had all the paperwork and Joe Pagan couldn't believe it. He offered me a job on the spot.
I bet he did. And I bet you that mayor was super happy you followed through.
Oh, I still don't think they understand what, you know, everything. I mean, so many things could have gone wrong, but we got it there and it all awesome. Worked out.
Wow, what a story. That was great. All right, so can you put your finger on what it is exactly about horses that cast a spell on you? And I want you to tell me if you can, has the way you feel about horses changed at all since you began riding at 9?
So I thought that actually was a great question because it has changed. And I don't think anyone can put the finger on it. I think you're born with it. Mm-hmm. I just think it's in you. It's in your blood. Somewhere along your bloodline, someone was horsey. And it happened to be my grandfather from my dad's side. It was in the military with the horses. So my dad always says, you know, it came from him. And I do think it's just born into you. And you just don't have a choice. It's your love. It's your passion. It's everything. However, I did make it my job and my career. So, you know, now even working with the footing and everything, I don't ride as much. I have lost that passion. I think just simply, it's a hard industry. It's not an easy industry. There's lots of great things about it, but it's a tough industry. You are going to work extremely hard to get ahead. So I think I just really got burnt out. And as much as I still love the horses, I would have, though I say this, and I own half a horse with a friend in Toronto. But that was after a few glasses of wine, too many, obviously. But I still love them, but I just don't have the passion to go ride anymore. I really don't.
Totally fair. Totally fair. And it's like, I don't know, when I, like I said, when I reread these questions and I'm preparing, and this one sort of struck me in a different way. And it's like I mentioned earlier, it's, I think when, you know, as these little girls or little guys, when we're, you know, falling in love with these ponies and we go to our lessons and then we get older and adulting gets in the way, and then we're finding jobs, and then we're like, oh, you know, whether you find a job in the industry or whether you, you know, have a job that promotes your passion or pays for your passion of owning a horse. I don't know. It just kind of reconnected. It's like, what are those magical connections? I think it's fair to ask or to hope that, you know, let's say even you with your footing business, which is amazing and provides such an important part to horse performance and athleticism, you're still within the industry. So there's still something that you're getting fed by being around them. And I know for me as a massage therapist, I still have moments of awe when I'm massaging them and it's just the horse and I. But it is, it's just like, wow, we really lose that childlike connection with them. And I think that if we could connect to that a little bit more, it could, you know, ignite something.
I know, I agree. I really do. My girlfriend and that I own the horse with, she stopped, she had a family, you know, and like you said, many of those things, but she's come back into the horses and she does, she's found that love and that passion and that, you know, devotion again. Yeah. And I wish I could, but I just, a big thing is the time. I don't have the time, you know, it takes up so much of your time and it's almost like I'm not, we're at a point where just getting on and riding, we want our goals because we are driven people. So, you know, I want a goal, I want to get on and I want to work towards maybe competing or doing something. And I don't have the time. So I think that's part of the moving on sort of process.
Yeah, totally. I mean, that's with the massaging, I have a completely different relationship with them than most people do when I work with these horses. And for some of them for years and years and years, but I have not ridden a horse. I've been on a horse once in the last 24, 25 years. And it's weird. It's like people that started me riding, basically, like this woman who's also like my second mom, she's like, so when are we getting you back on a horse? And I'm like, I don't know. Because exactly what you said, Karen, if I were to get on a horse, I'd be like, all right, I want to work towards a goal.
Yeah.
Maybe go into a show. Like, and it's just like, that's just the way I'm wired. So I don't know. And there are so many things that I have going on that maybe it's just best if I continue to love them the way I am doing. It's weird.
Well, and I think your connection for me, I get where you're coming from. Your connection is with the horse on the ground.
Mm-hmm.
And as a groom, because I groomed for so many years.
Yes.
My connection was really with them on the ground because I didn't, you know, I was never really talented enough to be a rider, but my connection was with them on the ground. So long as I felt like you're around them, you sort of feel at home.
Yes.
And I always think that, I think, I traveled a lot. And of course, you miss home, you miss your family. But I never felt away from home because home was where the horses were.
Mm-hmm.
So long as I was always with the horses, I never felt so far away from home, if that makes sense.
Totally. Now, we've kind of gone into the next question, but at what point did it become clear that horses were going to be your future profession? And if it was clear that you weren't going to have a future riding, which you've just shared about, was it at all frightening or confusing for you to sort out what that was going to be?
No, I think, you know, really from 13, I knew all I wanted to do was be with horses. I just had to figure out how I was going to make that work. And really the riding, I mean, of course, everybody wants to be a rider, you know, that's our dream. But really what cut that dry was having to work. So I couldn't fund myself. The background didn't enable any funding. So my big thing was I did do my BHS exams in the UK, and I worked as a groom, and I actually found that really fulfilling and enjoyed it, and worked with some amazing people that taught me so much. And you know, you're like a sponge, you take a little bit from everybody and you try to absorb it all and keep moving up the ladder as far as working for bigger and better professionals. And really that was, you know, for me, I just sort of fell into that and enjoyed it. Again, just enjoyed being around the horses. It was a way I could provide for myself, you know, and work and be around them. And really it wasn't hard, because again, my intentions were just to make it work.
Well, and I think it kind of goes back to that very first characteristic of yours, like someone that has your determination, your ability to get stuff done, you know, organization, all of that kind of stuff. I truly believe that, you know, all of us have these different aspects that make us good at what we do within the horse industry. So I've known so many grooms over the years, and it's turned into entrepreneurial and business for you too, that kind of character or characteristic really benefits. Like that, you are the kind of people that those riders want as their groom.
Yeah, no, absolutely. You know, you have to be so dedicated, but at the same time, be able to step back and see the big picture. Mm-hmm. And really, you know, I mean, I've worked some great people, and you do have to be thinking on your feet. You know, you get so many things shouted at you, get this done, blah, 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 and you're like, oh, okay, and you're like a little calculator, you know, taking everything in, thinking, okay, well, I've got to do this, 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 and this, and sort of right away put it in an order that makes sense as you're running from the ring back to the stables, you know? So, it's just how my mind's worked from an early age, just figure it out and do it.
Yeah. All right. So that does, when you mentioned some of those wonderful people that you worked with, you mentioned working with the Gayford family, as well as with Mark Hayes and Torchy Miller. Those are some big names here in the equestrian world in Canada. Can you tell me what working with them helped to teach you and how it made you a better horsewoman?
Well, the Gayfords are still great friends. I just love them all. They're great. So I started there at the age of 21, and I started as a nanny and housekeeper because it was the only job that they were looking for. Again, back then, the grooms, it was, you know, everyone was settled and had their good grooms. And I thought I'd last 5 minutes in the house anyway. Lo and behold, Tom's family were British. So everything I cooked, he'd be like, oh, I haven't had that since my mum and dad were alive. And I'm thinking, no, I want to be in the barn. But anyway, it was great, because what it allowed was I rode with Tom. Every night I would ride, because he worked full time. And he would come home and ride in the evenings. And so it was great. So he taught me, and he is such a kind man with all of his knowledge. I mean, I rode show ponies and naughty ponies. So I always had rather hard hands, and he really taught me soft hands and was incredible. And as far as my riding, he improved my riding no end, and it was so much fun. I mean, it was great. I was with them for probably 2 years, and then I traveled, and then I came back and finished off another season with them. So I really enjoyed my time there. Still great friends with Margie and all the girls. So that was great. Mark's was, I was grooming full time, and he had a lot of good young riders in his farm. And I would work with him very closely. And you know what? He really I listened, and he was a great trainer. He was a great trainer with those young riders. He would give them so much confidence and never, not overface them, but not give them too much information, you know? Yeah. So I really learned from his instruction, and he, you know, he was very good with the young riders. Overworked, of course, I was. But it was great. Again, it was some fun times. And Torchy, I actually worked for in Ireland. And he had me there look after a stable with Tommy Brennan. And we were in Dublin, just outside of Dublin. And they were buying and selling horses. Mm-hmm. So that was interesting. There wasn't a bad horse that came through there. I mean, they were young horses, but you could see the potential. I mean, they really have a great eye for good horses. So that was a lot of fun. And then, of course, I did the games with Torchy. So he was just, wow. He was just super. Always very, very fair with every decision, and was great to work with.
Like you said earlier in our little conversation here so far, to be a sponge and the hard work. So it's, wow, I could only imagine. You just want to like soak up every single thing you heard them say, the advice. And what stuck the most for any of those three people or family that you, what was the thing that stuck with you the most?
Oh gosh, you know, really Tom Gayford's dedication to the sport. When I was with him, he was chef to keep.
Oh.
And oh my God. I mean, the hours that he would put in after, like we would ride, we would come back to the house. We'd eat dinner around 7:30 to 8:30. Then he'd go back to his home office and work on all the ins and outs of being a chef to keep. And, you know, his dedication and his love to the sport was really just mind-blowing. And really just, he would do anything and everything to help. He was unbelievable as far as the horsemanship that he had, you know, from his father again, which was military-based. You know, and one of my very first trainers that I worked for in the UK was military based. So there was I saw a lot of similarities there. A little bit harder, you know, with the animal, didn't quite wrap them up in cotton wool like we all do today. Let them be a horse a bit more. But his solid dedication to the sport, and still, he's still rocking it, you wow. know.
That's yeah. amazing. So inspiring. And I think that's such a good message for just if you want something that badly, you have to really work for it. You have to plan your time. You have to be efficient and dedicated and disciplined. There's so many aspects to that.
Oh, yeah. I mean, you the sport requires you to live and breathe it.
Yeah,
it really does. And whether you're a groom, a trainer, a rider, in a farrier, a footing, I mean, it demands that.
Yeah,
that's, you know, and I think you can't do this part time.
No, you can't.
No.
All right. So you said your time at the Sydney Olympics was fabulous. What did you take out of that experience that's still with you today?
Do you know, just being in that position was so, you know, just awesome. Like it's, I still like think, wow, you know, how did I swing that one, you know? Wow. But it was just such an amazing place to be. I love Sydney. I love Australia. One of my favorite countries. And they so embraced the games. I mean, they really did. And I felt all, again, friends that I'd worked for in the past came and helped. And I mean, I think looking back, managing personalities of all the different team members, grooms, vets, everybody. There's so many people involved. Then you have all their entourage, you know, that come along with them. So that was challenging, but one of the best things was I managed to get a spot to march into opening ceremonies. And it's weird how that happens. So because not all the athletes are there right on opening day, because it's 2 weeks. So it's very important that they're doing whatever they're doing. And then they fly over all different intervals. So it goes down the line through each discipline, whether you're an athlete, a horse person, you know, wherever you are. So it dropped down to me. Well, do you want to walk in? I was like, hell yeah, you know. Yeah. So the great thing was I somehow was about six back from the flag bearer. So I managed to be on the front of the newspaper, you know, the Toronto Star, which my friend laughed as I was going out. He's like, oh, watch it. You'll end up being the bloody flag bearer on that. Well, I wasn't far from it, let me tell you.
Who was the flag bearer? I can't remember.
Oh God, you know what? I don't remember.
Okay.
I have a picture behind me, but I don't remember. I should have done my due diligence, shouldn't I? But
that's okay. You
know, it was that was just incredible. That was incredible. So it was so much fun getting all the Canadian stuff and just proud.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Cool. So is there a part of you that's kind of Canadian?
Oh, it's so difficult. So I'm British born.
Yes.
Living in the United States, but Canada gave me all my biggest opportunities. Aww. It really did. Yeah.
Really?
And I would say probably my best friends are all in Canada. Like, so wonderful, great, great friends that I've got up there still.
Ah, that's wonderful. That's good to hear. That's great. All right, Karen, so talk to me about footing first. You said it was like a light bulb going off for you. So walk me through what your early idea was like and how and what it's become now.
So yeah, well, all started at Sydney Olympics. I was there and the footing wasn't really great. And so you started paying attention. So from Sydney, I really started watching and looking at all different arena footings. And, you know, when I think back, I thought, God, who do you call in North America if you want to build an arena? And I couldn't come up with anything or anyone. So, so I really started to think, wow, there's a real niche here in the industry, because all I knew is if you wanted to do something, you know, there was one person in Canada that everybody called, but it wasn't anything amazing, you know, and if you called a sandpit or an excavator, they didn't talk the same language, you know, they didn't understand what our needs were because they weren't horse people. So I just thought, wow, you know, I really need to research this. So I did research it for quite a time, and I ended up going to 2002 World Equestrian Games in Jerez, again for the Canadian team. And they had super footing there. It was actually the French footing. It was very good. But there were still things that I didn't like about it. And then directly from there, I went to the UK and saw great stuff. And that was really, I thought, okay, that's what I want to resource. That's what I want to do. And so I just sort of started working and, you know, grabbing different things, again, being the sponge, taking different ideas, looking at different things and trying to come up with something that was better than everything else that was on the market.
Wow.
It took a few years, and then a great friend who's passed away, sadly, but I told her, great Irish girl, Julianne Vard, and she went, oh, you have to talk to Lawton Adams. So I was like, oh, okay. And we were, you know, she saw that we were like yin and yang, and he's very much, I'm always optimistic, oh, we can do it, and he'd be like, I'm not so sure, you know. So we were actually very good for each other, and we're still, you know, 20 years on, great business partners, and it's really worked out super. It's really the best thing I ever did.
So can you put into words what the journey from idea to reality has been like? Because like, as I'm listening to you and as I'm, again, processing this as we're just chatting, don't you almost need to be a civil engineer?
So I had really the footing world. Lawton had been building arenas for many years before I came along. And he had been already mixing sand and clay. Mm-hmm. And you're absolutely right, where his thing when I said, oh, look, you know, you've got to see this. He was like, wow, that's, you have no idea how difficult that is. So we had a huge boost because John Grange from Lothlorien Farm up there in Canada, again, Canada really gave me all my leg ups. He bought the footing from a company in Europe, which I brought to his attention. And so we were able to really backward engineer the product and obviously do some changes here and there. And it wasn't easy. There were certain things we couldn't do, but it gave us a platform of something to shoot for. And it took us a good 6 months in the lab, sort of, to mess with things and come up with something that we thought was close. But really, it was basically trial and error.
That's fascinating to me. And the technology that's behind footing nowadays, like every arena I walk into, if I'm watching a horse go on a line or watching a horse being ridden, is the first thing I think any horse person does. They walk in, they look down, they step around on it, they get a feel of what this footing is. And there's a whole mishmash of stuff out there that I've stepped on. But yeah, like, would you not say that there is technology involved in this? And would you say that sometimes it's over the top? Like, how would you describe it?
So it's getting there. We're still behind the eight ball. Mm. And as a company, I've been very involved with a lot of universities. Again, Guelph University was great. I've been working with them. I worked with a great guy. I'll have to think. But he introduced me. I think he's retired now, actually. He did a great white paper on horses and the absorption that's already, you know, because I grew up hunting. So, you know, you would be trotting and cantering down the road.
Yeah.
And, you know, that absorption is already somewhat built into the horse's hoof and system. So he had done this big white paper. And so I contacted him and I got in touch with Mick Peterson, who was at Maine University at the time. Now he's in Kentucky, still actually talking to him, just spoke to him the other day. And that's my phone. Don't need to. I'm sorry. I wish I could turn it off.
That's okay.
So just ignore it. So we as a company, it does need to be scientific, and it is getting more and more scientific. But there was no standard. And there still truly really isn't a standard. The FEI is trying to get there. And there's been many meetings, but we as a company have tested with Mick Peterson with what they call the OBST. It's a hoof drop mechanism. Okay. And Lars Strofholm from the University of Sweden is very involved with testing. So the FEI now is testing a lot more. There's many other Labo Sport. I had test all my footings because they were in the mix of perhaps being, you know, going down that road because they test sports surfaces.
Okay.
So like the NFL and baseball, none of those pitches are not, they're all tested prior to big games. So when you think of our industry and the millions of dollars in horse flesh, we need to get more testing and more scientific. And we've worked with, like I say, pretty much every different testing board that's trying to figure out a standard or figure out a way of testing arenas. But each horse, when I tested with Guelph, every horse had its own personal preference. you know, because when you think of the horses, they can be a little, you know, a little vertical through their hoof, or a little bit more flat footed, or, you know, there's so many different biomechanics to how they move individually. So that's why the hoof drop machine, it's a bit like there's a machine that tests golf balls. Mm-hmm. So you've got to have the same thing every time, because if you have 100 different horses, you could have 100 different results.
Wow. So this foot drop thing you're describing, is it like a weight or a mechanical?
It's an engineered mechanical device that drops at a certain pressure at the same angle as the hoof does after like a 1.50 meter jump.
Wow.
Yeah. It's pretty neat.
And do you guys get into specifics between different disciplines? Like what about reiners, or is your footing first specific to hunter jumper world?
We do everything. We're doing more and more in the reining world. We can help somebody backyard with just, you know, building a good arena and just putting some plain sand, or we can, you know, work for McLean Ward, which is a lovely name to say. We do everything, and like you said, it is a science. It's not easy, but and every professional also has their personal opinion on how they want it. You know, some people, more of your dressage, want to have a footing that's a little bit more movement, a little bit more sheer. Mm-hmm. And then your jumper riders at home want that. But I think everybody really at the end of the day wants a footing that's got life, that's got some responsiveness to it.
That's a cool way to describe it. Yeah. Huh.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. So do you feel any pressure to put your best foot forward, so to speak, without a good base and footing for the horses to go on? Riders can't be at their best. So how do you deal with knowing that a lot of what could happen, good or bad, comes back to you and your product? And again, it comes back to the technology and making sure everybody's getting what they want.
Absolutely. It's education.
Yeah.
You know, everything really goes back to education. So I always, everybody's budget is different, and that's what is going to rule the whole decision. So what you try to do is educate your client, your person, on exactly what the most important values are. One being a base, a proper base is, you know, I tell people all the time, listen, don't worry about what you can and can't afford for the surface. If you build the base correctly, it will allow you to interchange your footing, you know, when you can afford to. But there's so many different ways to build a base. So, you know, it just comes down to being able to educate your person on what they can and can't do, and really what is going to be either the most maintenance or the least maintenance. Mm-hmm. And, you know, again, if you're, a lot of my owners are, ladies that got young children or are older in their years, where they finally have the money to have their home, you know, and have the horse and enjoy it. So, you know, you've got to really say, okay, the last thing you want to be doing is chasing your tail, dragging the arena and watering the arena. And, you know, you want to just spend the time with your horse. So spend a little more up front, and you'll get a longer product with better long longevity, and it will be less maintenance, so you can spend more time with the horse.
Okay.
But again, you know, it's about education and being able to help somebody make a wise decision with the budget that they have.
Okay, cool. I've never heard of it described that way, and I've never thought of it that way. So that's very interesting, because some places I go to, every day at noon during lunch hour or whatever, the arena gets dragged. And I'm like, well, that is a lot of time.
Yes. Yeah. So, yeah. Well, sort of like at the Royal, you know, if you think of the Royal Winter Fair, which a lot of your people will be familiar with, we don't have to water that surface. So when those classes just, you know, I mean, that ring goes from 4 a.m. in the morning till midnight sometimes. Yeah. So.
Well, sorry, just to be clear for the listeners, that footing first provides the footing for the Royal. So that's your footing.
Yes, we do. That's our high performance travel right blend that we call. It doesn't require any water for its performance. So we put it in and it gets rolled, and because we're right on top of the cement at the Royal. So, you know, and the fact that it doesn't need water means that we save time, and that the whole indoors, you know, that building stays clean because there's no dust. You know, when you think of the Royal, we have the restaurant right next to the arena. You wouldn't be able to do that with a, you know, a dusty water dependent blend.
Yeah. Okay. So two things have popped into my mind. One of it being like, when you think back to how we were as kids, and even, you know, the Gayfords when Tommy was first riding, how much footing has changed. With your science background and your experience and your developing this product, how much more can it change?
Well, yeah, that's a great question. I think we're very close. Everything can always be improved on, right? No matter what. But I think that we're very close to getting there. There's still things that can be worked on. It's really about trying to create a footing and learning as to what that absolute fine line is between enough movement and too much movement, too little, too much. You know, that you riders, what we found is, I think that the footing world went very much too firm, and horses were getting injured in a different way. And now we've got to sort of back away from that. But you know, you want the horses to be able to pat the ground on the takeoff and feel secure. But on the landing, you want something that moves a little bit more and allows for a little bit more concussion value. So there's lots of things that are moving forward. There's different mats that you can put between a base and have a firmer footing, but the mat allows for a little bit more sort of forgiveness, but the footing stays firm on the surface. There is definitely things moving along, but I think we're very close to the, you know, getting it as perfect as we can.
Right.
We're not far. There's been, in the last 20 years, like you said, you know, we've gone from just a good sand ring, which, you know, when you've got good sand and you've got the right equipment and enough water, you can make that good. But it's the hours and the time and the labor that goes into that. And that's where the footing has evolved, where we don't have the time and the labor and the resources. And the horse shows need to get 50 horses through the ring before they drag them water. So, you know, our sport has grown at a huge rate. I was in Wellington last week. I mean, they had 7,000 horse entries for one day. 7,000.
Wow.
Imagine how many horses are down there. That's just one day of entries. I mean, so those arenas have to stand up. And again, our the whole horse world, I believe, you know, we used to finish at the Royal. Horses would rest through the winter. We'd start to bring them back up, you know, March. In the UK, it was the same. We would sort of have our last horse show at Christmas at Olympia. The horses would be thrown out in the field and we'd bring them back in end of March, you know, and everyone would go hunting for the winter. So, you know, now we go to Florida, we go to Spain, there's all these other horse shows throughout the year. So our good horses show an awful lot, and we're at horse shows an awful lot. So footing has become more and more and more important because there's no breaks anymore.
Absolutely. So, and the other little thought I had regarding injuries. So I can completely understand, maybe this is a bit of the massage therapist coming out in me, but as far as managing their tendons and their ligaments and everything in their legs, years ago when I can understand footing was hard. But now, you know, I've heard over the years, since the technology in footing has become such a thing, is there something to be said, or is there something about it that you consider when a horse is working on something that's perfect all the time? Like, they need different to feel different forces on their tendons and ligaments to be strong, right? Is there something of that in how you promote your, or sorry, build your product?
Well, I totally agree. So for me, if I have a client that's building a new facility, I will push them towards different footings. So they may have the dust free indoors, which is a little softer, has a lot more forgiveness to it, because I can create it because it's not relying on moisture for its performance value. And then outdoors, you go to a water-based footing, which then the more water you add, the firmer it can be, or you can back away from the water and you can tweak it to a little bit what your needs are. Always at home, you want a softer footing, in my opinion. A lot of people will have turf, you know, so then you've got your turf arena too. I mean, in the UK, we used to do a lot of road work with our horses, which I think is getting lost over the years. Mm-hmm. I mean, a good stone dust paths, you know, to trot. A lot of people are doing lovely trails around their properties as well, which I always try to push them towards a good stone dust, because then, you know, again, it's like cross training.
Yes.
You know, you've got a few different surfaces. The horse shows have to have their footing as perfect as they possibly can, but that will always tend to be on the firmer side because they're running so many horses through and they don't really have much of a choice there. But at home, you know, I do push people to have different footings, and we do have variations, so we can as a company work with that and bring different variations. There's not a lot of companies that can do and create a good dust-free blend. And that's something that really we started our company off, was creating Travel Right, which was our major footing and our biggest seller and our high priority, because it was a high performance footing. And really it's changed over the years, it's evolved, but it's, I've still got arenas that are 18 years old and they're performing amazing. I mean, they're still great. Yeah. Yeah.
Now does your business take you all over the world? Like, do you have different barns? Are you coming up in Canada and putting your footing down up here, or what are you doing?
I'm all over North America.
Okay.
But I don't travel abroad. I have great people that I know over there. And you know what? I don't feel, and this is something that me and my business partner, I can service. I go back and forth to Toronto, to Calgary, to BC. That's no problem. We're doing a lot more on the West Coast. That's where we've sort of been expanding to over the last few years. But it's service, you know. These new footings and you know, they're not inexpensive. So I feel, you know, that it's a service, you know, and if somebody's spending that amount of money with a company, that if there's a question or a problem, you need to be able to get there and get there fairly rapidly.
Yeah.
So Europe, you know, as much as would be lovely, because I'd see my family, how am I going to look after those clients as well as I could if they're in my backyard, you know? Mm-hmm. So we have great companies that we associate abroad, and we just, you know, if anybody is interested, we always send them, you know, to some good people.
Wow. Yeah, I knew I was looking forward to this conversation for a reason. There's so many parts of it. I mean, you are just lovely and hilarious, and I love your stories. And yeah, like how you get to be like developing footing. I mean, everybody knows no foot, no horse. So this is such an important part to the everyday thing. And I've, you know, seen instances where I'm like, okay, these people, they got to put some work into their footing, or people that are like obsessed with it.
Yes.
You know, so finding a great balance. This is fascinating. So you've had quite an interesting evolution in your equestrian journey. I am curious to know what you think of the path you've taken and the imprint it's left on you. Reflecting back on what you've accomplished so far in your life, what are you hoping your legacy will be?
Oh, gosh. So really, you know, looking back, grooming and working for such great professionals and working hard and having a good reputation at that level allowed me to have the contacts, you know, for my business, and allowed me to be able to go up to Torchy Miller, Mark Hayes, Beth Underhill, even Eric, you know, I mean, so many great people in Canada that helped me and listened to me and had faith in, you know, because I think I had created a reputation as a groom, you know, so no matter how low the totem pole or where you are in any career, how good you do that path and how hard you work there and you know, the respect that you gain, whether you're mucking stalls, muck it the best you can, it doesn't matter, you know, and that's, I think, has been my backbone in then creating and being able to work hard and people respect you for your work ethic. And so I enabled and opened doors for me. It really did. And never being like, I was a groom. There's nothing at all bad about being a groom. I loved it. You know, I loved it. There is. And again, it's not having a chip on your shoulder. It's being like, hey, I'm proud of what I do. I don't care. It doesn't bother me. I've got a thick skin, I guess. I just think, you do the best at whatever you do and you can keep moving up that ladder. And it really helped me, and also being a bit bold, you know, when I look back at some of the things, you know, walking up to Joe Farges and I was like, oh my God, how he didn't know me from Adam. You know, I'm like, hey, Joe, well, I'm Karen Leeming, you know, and just having the boldness and the bravery to just put yourself out there.
Yep.
And, you know, it served me well. I mean, I don't have any bravery left in me, let me tell you. I couldn't do that now, but now I'm a little bit more, have a reputation where, you know, I sort of could, but it's funny. I think I had nothing to lose. So it made me brave. And I just thought, God damn it, I'm going to do this. Again, there's that determination that you spoke about. But
that's right.
You know, always trying to do things better. Like even now, you know, we're constantly trying to do things better, trying to make a better footing for the horses so as they have a better surface, so as they're not in any pain. You know, I mean, it's just trying to do the thing to make it better for the animal. And really, I think moving forward, we just keep trying to improve constantly.
Well, that in itself is a legacy and what you, you know, leave behind and for the people who use your product and stuff. So I guess in another way, thinking as you were talking about your relationship with the Gayfords and Mark and Torchy, is there anybody you're mentoring? Is there any aspect of what you've learned through this process that you have seen yourself or of thinking about paying it forward? I say in air quotes. Is there something?
Yeah, there's a couple girls that are with us in the company that are young horsewomen.
Nice.
And their background, their parents are contractors. So that's been great, you know, getting them out in the industry and also women, which is nice.
Yes.
There's not a lot of women out there doing the footing industry and contractors and working with the men, because most men excavators are all guys. So I do have some great women that are great. And so we're trying to develop them and get them going in the industry, because you know it's nice, and they're the younger, you know, they're in their mid to late 20s, so they're the next generation. And there's some good, great people out there. I really am looking forward to maybe doing less, and I would love to go back to teaching. I love teaching. I really enjoy teaching. I used to work at Wingberry Farm for Sean Littler Nahari Littler, great, again, great people, loved, had many great years there. And I really enjoyed teaching. So I would love to sort of get back to my roots there with that. But as far as the company and the industry and the things we've learned, yeah, we've got some great people. And I work with a lot of contractors that are getting into the industry. And again, you know, the more people, the better people doing the work and doing it right is, again, better for the whole equestrian world.
Exactly. Yeah. Karen, thank you so much. This has been a lot of fun. And I really hope that the listeners, like, you know, of all the different variety of guests that I have on, like, you know, footing, absolutely. I want to talk to somebody who, you know, is at the top of their game with something that's so important. So this has been wonderful. How can people find you or reach out to you if they have any questions about footing for themselves?
Oh, lovely. That, yeah, that we have a website, Footing First. And you can reach me. I'm Karen at footingfirst.com. But if you go on the website, you can find myself and Diane, who's new with us just recently. So that's great. She's going to be awesome. And yeah, no, it's been great talking to you. And really, at the end of the day, like you said, it's one of the most important things for our world. And as you know, being a massage therapist, you feel everything, you know. Yeah. So you feel the tightness and you know, things have happened. It's there's a lot of overlap with sports fields as well as our industry. So it's, you know, what the football players and the baseball players have been getting hurt further up in their hips. And, you know, and it's the same in our horses, especially in our thoroughbreds, you yeah. know. So there's a lot. But I think being horsey related and having the background in the industry and understanding the biomechanics is a huge part for me to help with what I see in the footing industry.
That's awesome. And the horses are going to be much better for it.
Let's hope. Yes.
Awesome. Thank you, Karen.
Thank you. That was great. Cheers. See you again.
So there you have it. I have some great interviews lined up for future episodes, and we'll be covering some pretty interesting topics, as always, with the intent to open and engage the horse world on a wide variety of issues. So until next time, keep your eyes forward and continue to hit your stride. To stay current with Hitting Your Stride, subscribe on my website or wherever you download your favorite podcasts. If you like what you've heard here today, make sure you share and leave a comment to help guide future episodes and widen the audience. And be sure to check out social media to keep up to date with Equestrian Elements Life Coaching.